Hi guys, welcome back to Millennial Mirrors, a discussion on millennial life in the Middle East. So on this week's episode, we'll be discussing addiction with psychologist Reem Shaheen, where we talk about things like the definition of addiction, what are some of the biggest misconceptions about it, how to recognize the bad habits you're developing, and what could be done in the region to help addiction and the problems that people are facing with it. So tune in and hope you enjoy the episode. This episode is sponsored by Carriage, a great app for ordering what you need in a super convenient way, with no minimum orders. You could literally just order a cup of coffee. So hi, Reem. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Mashari. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. Can you tell the listeners a bit about yourself before we get started?
So I'm a counseling psychologist. I trained and I studied mental health and wellness. I'm a trained psychotherapist. On side, I did extensive studies on working with eating disorders and addiction. Mm-hmm. So that's my specialty. I mainly work with adults.
Okay.
I practiced in New York, Cairo, and here in Dubai.
Okay, great. So our topic today is about addiction, and which is a topic that you have quite a bit of experience with.
Yes.
So for the listeners, can you give a definition of addiction?
Okay. Well, addiction is somewhat of a complex condition,
mm-hmm.
but the manifestation is mainly with a compulsive need to use a drug, whatever mm-hmm. that drug is. There's a compulsion to use it despite the consequences, and most of the time the consequences are usually harmful.
Mm-hmm.
So what you see is that people with addiction will usually, there's part of it that has to do with the brain. I won't bore you with that, but the behavior is an intense need to get this drug. And eventually what develops are two things, the tolerance and the withdrawal. The tolerance is that with time you will need more in order to get the same effect of the drug. So you mm-hmm. start building that. And then the withdrawal are the physical or the psychological effects that the individual will go through if they don't get the drug, which kind of emphasizes or makes the compulsion even worse. So that's, in a nutshell, kind of how addiction is viewed.
And I guess, how do you know when you've crossed the threshold into addiction from, like, get just regular use?
The way we look at it is that it can go from regular use to mm-hmm. abuse,
mm-hmm.
and then there's addiction. Addiction is when most of your time is spent on being under the drug, thinking about the drug, or thinking mm-hmm. about how you're going to obtain the drug.
Okay.
So your life starts to revolve around the drug. And every other aspect of your life somewhat falls apart. And this is when it becomes an addiction.
Okay, I see. And what are some of the different types of addiction that can happen?
Addiction is usually we just call it substance abuse or mm-hmm. substance use. And then there's legal and illegal drugs, obviously. And then there's other stuff. So the legal and illegal drugs, I mean, alcohol is a legal drug, nicotine, caffeine, those are legal drugs.
Mm-hmm.
There's the prescription ones like painkillers and opioids, such as codeine, oxytocin, heroin, which is illegal, but you can find morphine. And then there's the sedatives, and anxiety, anti-anxiety, Xanax, Ambien, all that. Highly
right.
addictive, but still legal. And then you have the illegal drugs like the hallucinogenic, LSD, PCP, and then the cocaine.
Those heroin, are, all those kinds of things.
Cocaine and heroines and methamphetamines and all of that are illegal.
Yeah, I think
drugs.
The reason I asked that is because I think there's still this kind of big misconception with a large percentage of the population where they think the only substances or the only things considered drugs are illegal substances, whereas there are a lot of legal things that you could do and be addicted to.
Yes. That's, I mean, the most common one and alcohol.
Yeah.
But then also you see caffeine. Everybody's walking around with a cup of coffee or with a Red Bull or with drinking some kind of a stimulant. These are they're categorized as stimulants and needing that kick in order to be able, I can't get out of bed before I get I drink my coffee. I can't function if I don't have a Red Bull. So those are drugs that are affecting your heart rate, your brain functioning, your level of stimulation, and are considered legal.
I think
nicotine is the same thing.
So many people notice that, especially during Ramadan, because of the fact that they can't have their coffee.
They can't have their
and
coffee.
Suddenly the headache kicks in and all those things kick in. And it's like
this
all those.
This is withdrawal.
Yeah, withdrawal. Exactly. And that's when you know that you have an addiction.
You have
issue.
An addiction. And then it's important to think about how many cups of coffee do you have and how many did you used to have, or maybe not even have how many cups of coffee. Sometimes how strong the coffee is.
Yeah.
You keep making it stronger in order to get the same kick. People who smoke cigarettes, what did you start by smoking and now how strong is the cigarette that you're smoking and how many cigarettes a day? These are indicators of addiction.
And so what do you think are, or where do you think is the biggest misconception about addiction in the region?
I think the biggest misconception is that it's not a problem unless we're injecting or snorting something.
Mm.
Otherwise, it's fine. So if my doctor prescribed me Xanax, that's completely fine, but which is can be okay. But then at the same time, how many times are you taking that Xanax? How many pills are you taking? For how long? What is the purpose? What was it prescribed for? And then looking at the individual's personality.
Mm.
And do I have a tendency to get addicted to or hooked to substances? And if that's a tendency, then stay away from these kinds of substances because they are highly addictive. They have the biological component. So if you, as an individual, have that tendency, then it's not going to turn out well. So it's, and it's also people, the misconception is always in the way people think of it as, well, it's a pill, it's not going to do anything. And actually, no, a lot of the studies are showing the short-term effect of these pills. Nothing is showing the long-term effects of being on those pills for a long time.
And you said something interesting about tendency. So what do you mean by tendency exactly?
With like anything in when it comes to mental health and mental wellness, it's not there's always the biological component. So there's always the genetic, we call it the genetic predisposition. So some
right.
people will be predisposed to some stuff, like alcoholism, for example. It runs in families. There's a predisposition for some people to develop that kind of addiction. So you know you have the gene for it, but just because you have the gene for it doesn't mean that you're going to get it.
Mm.
It means that if the circumstances allow for themselves and if you have the personality for it, then it will kick in.
Right.
So there's the environment that comes to play into effect. And this is where an individual awareness of themselves and of their circumstances and what they're going through is important for them to be able to see whether they will in the future, whether they have the tendency to develop an addiction or not. And in that case, kind of try to limit their exposure to any addictive substances.
And I guess if you don't know whether or not you historically you have a tendency towards addiction, is there any kind of way for you to find out if you have a genetic predisposition?
The genetic predisposition will be that somebody in the family has been struggling with some kind of an addiction. So that's the genetic predisposition. With alcoholism, it's specific, but with drugs, it's general.
Okay.
Or dependency on a substance. So if that's running in the family, then that would be a genetic predisposition. But then there's the environmental factors, a lack of parental supervision during childhood is an indicator to a development of a drug use as grown-up. Poor social skills, aggressive behavior in childhood, community poverty, availability of drugs at home or school or in the community. These are all indicators. Again, I'm not saying that somebody who has this specific circumstance would develop an addiction, but these are all indicators. These are all positive factors, correlators, yeah. correlations with addiction. So that would be the indicators. This is what you look for. And then personal struggles. I mean, a lot of the times when I work with individuals who struggle with any kind of addiction, to me, honestly, it's never the fact that they're addicted, and it's never really the drug. I look at the drug just to understand the personality, what they're mm-hmm. looking for, a downer or an upper. But in general, to me, the drug is just an indication that there is a problem. It's not really the problem. Mm. The problem is that you're using something to fill some kind of a hole within yourself or right. something that's missing. So you start looking for that. And so when people, if for example, you've always been drinking coffee and then it goes into nicotine and then you use some kind of a mellow drug and then a higher up drug, or you're experimenting with drugs, of course, experimenting with drugs at a young age is also an indicator, then be more wary than somebody who doesn't have this tendency. If you are the person who cannot just have one drink and go home, it has to prolong into the night, then yeah, I would say that there might be something there into the relationship with the drug. And it doesn't have to turn into an addiction for you to start looking at your relationship with any kind of drug. It's actually, it's more preventative to look at it when it's just still a use or maybe a little bit of abuse. I'm having such a bad day, so I'm going to go home and pour myself a glass of wine, and then it becomes like, every time I'm having a bad day, I'm pouring myself a glass of wine. So the drug is being used for something. It has some kind of a function.
Right. Yeah. And I guess from you and your relationship with whatever substances you're using. What about for the people in your life, or if you have someone in your life, what are some of the symptoms or indicators for you to see that someone might be suffering from addiction or might be developing a very unhealthy relationship with some sort of substance?
The indicators are always that they would be extremely agitated if they're not on the drug, or if they don't have access to the drug. They're always thinking about the drug. You have people, the first thing that they, when they if they live in a country where alcohol is not allowed, the first thing that they do as soon as they land in a country where alcohol is allowed, first thing I need is to obtain that substance. Even with smoking, you have people, as soon as they get out of an airplane, this I notice this a lot, the first thing they do is they're lighting up a cigarette. I'm like, that's a bit much. So that constant need to be obtaining to obtain the drug. You look at also their level of functioning in the rest of their lives, if it's affecting the rest of their life. If it's affecting your relationship with other, your work, your studies, all of that, then it's a problem. And you're obviously going to observe it. Aggressive behavior, withdrawal, especially with teenagers, I mean, with parents. If you're noticing that your child is withdrawn all the time or sitting in their room a lot of the time, this is somewhat of an indication that there might be drug use, or there might be a mental health issue, definitely. But drug use, especially for teenagers. So these are the indicators, is that they don't enjoy themselves unless they're under the influence of the drug. Their behavior changes.
And how do you then approach that topic with them? Or do you approach that topic with them?
It's important to approach it. It's not necessarily, doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a positive result out of it. Most of the time, the first result would be that there's going to be denial, and that is always the case. But then when you start compiling kind of the incidences and be like, yeah, but this happened and this happened and this happened and that happened, maybe they'll be able to recognize it. As the first element to recovery is always recognition. If they're, if the individual is not recognizing that they have a problem, then it's very, very hard to get them to recover. It's very hard to get them to treatment. And you can put them in a hospital, which happens a lot in the Middle East, but then they'll sober up for however long, and sometimes they can even get access to the drug in the hospital and then get out and go back to their usual self. So unless they recognize that they have a problem, it is hard to get them off the drug. And
in your experience, has there been an increase in addiction in the Middle East over the past few years?
There isn't any, I looked up that, there isn't any specific statistics on the Middle East. I mean, with some countries, and we don't know how accurate that would be. But then there is an increase of addiction all over the world. So I would assume that, yes, there is an increase of addiction in the Middle East. But the exact numbers, we don't have that.
Okay. All right, well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more with Reem. And I want to kind of talk to you about what advice you have for people who may be suffering from symptoms of addiction. All right, so we will be right back, guys. This episode is sponsored by Carriage UAE, where you can get everything from food to groceries and even pet supplies. As someone who orders pretty much everything, I pay a lot in delivery charges every month. But now you can sign up for Carriage Black for 20 dirhams a month and get unlimited free deliveries, which saves me a bunch of money so I can order even more stuff. If you haven't tried it out yet, go to your app store and download the Carriage app. Check out the episode description of this podcast for more info. And we're back with Reem. Okay, so I guess my next question for you is, what advice do you have for people who know someone who's suffering from addiction, other than, I guess, just confronting them about it?
Mm-hmm. Well, when somebody is struggling with an addiction, it kind of takes over their lives. So support is needed, but also you need to be aware to protect yourself because anybody could get sucked into that hole. So to maintain boundaries, but also maybe give support if you feel like that person is ready for to go in the road, on the road to recovery. So that's something. The other thing is that, especially for caregivers and partners and all of that, what tends to happen is that the caregiver or the partner would get sucked into the recovery of the individual who's struggling with the addiction and kind of leave their life behind and not really take care of themselves. So a lot of self-care is needed when you're a caretaker of someone who is struggling with an addiction, even if they are in recovery, even if they are trying to help themselves. You need to also take care of yourself. So that's something that constantly gets disregarded and ignored.
And you said protect yourself. What do you mean by that? Is it because, I guess, generally someone going through recovery is going to be lashing out and things like that?
They can be, depending on the drug, to be honest. It's if you're weaning off nicotine and caffeine, you're just going to be a little irritable, not aggressive. But then with other drugs, there can be some aggressive behavior. But not protect, I didn't mean protect themselves physically, but then protect themselves emotionally, because recovery is not a straight line. And this is what I tell my clients all the time. It's not a straight line. So there's going to be relapses. There's going to be a slip up where we're close to getting the drug. So to be emotionally invested in that as a partner or a family member, it's draining. So this is what I mean by protecting themselves. It's like, don't get too get involved, but don't get too involved, because expecting that recovery is a straight line is a recipe for a disaster for the person who's supporting the individual, the addict or the addict himself. And this is what we try to explain to them all the time. It's not a straight line.
Yeah.
So in that sense, maybe this is what I mean by protecting themselves and protecting their expectations and kind of preserving their own energy.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, that is easier said than done if you're like a mother or a sibling to someone who's suffering, or even a partner to someone who's suffering. It's probably easier said than done because you're so invested in that person, like, in general. Never mind just trying to get them to be better, but your life is all wrapped up in that person anyway.
Yes.
So I guess, how does one go about protecting themselves emotionally in that situation?
This is what a lot of people struggle with is boundaries, creating boundaries. And a lot of the times this would be the problem of the addict is that it's not that they use the drug, that it develops into an addiction where it's years and years of struggle, and then a lot of time getting into trouble with the law and with, I mean, this is how an addiction develops usually. And there's someone enabling that, and it's most of the time the family members. Because you get into trouble, we'll get you out, or we'll find a way to make the problem go away, or we'll find a way to do this. And this is what... These are the consequences that an addict doesn't face usually that leads them to go back and use the drug. Well, nothing really happened. I can get away with it. And that's the learned behavior. I can get away with it. So that's another part that doesn't really answer your question. That's the enabling part.
But that's super interesting because that is such a thing that you see so much here where there's the family enabling an individual's bad behavior.
Yes.
Out of what in their mind is unconditional love.
Protecting them.
Yeah.
I don't want to, if we're talking about a mother, this is her teenage son, 18, 19, 20. She doesn't want his future to be ruined if he gets in an accident under the influence of a drug or gets arrested or anything like that. So they would do whatever needs to, the family will do whatever needs to be done in order for him to get away with it. But what this individual learns is, I can get away with it.
Yeah. And so I think, what you said about boundaries is very, very important in the sense that, like, you have to set those boundaries and realize that at the end of the day, that person is a fully grown adult who is responsible for their own actions. And after a certain extent, you can only help them so much before it's up to them to step up and kind of try to help themselves.
Exactly. This is, addiction is an illness. It's, and we agree on that. I'm not blaming the addict here. Mm. But at the same time, unless the addict takes responsibility and starts to recognize the problem and wants to go and get help, it is not on anyone around them to try to help them. It is not your responsibility. As a parent, as a sibling, as a partner, that's not your responsibility. So getting involved in that and pushing and really, this is a lack of boundary. So creating the boundary of, no, I'm going to do my life. I'm going to take care of myself. When you're ready, I will support you. But unless you're ready, I can't do anything. And it's recognizing that difference in creating that boundary, which is very, very hard.
And I guess when you're treating someone, do you usually just treat them individually, or is it usually them and the family together? I mean, how does that usually work?
Usually, I work with individuals, but I mean, one of the trainings that I got was basically the belief that you can't really work with the individual and send them back to the same dysfunctional family and then they would go back to the drug. So usually I would recommend that they get a family treatment or that their partners or whatever family members they have for them to go into their own therapy. And it helps a lot. I've seen people, there's a higher tendency to recovery if the other members of the family are doing their work on themselves as well.
Right.
Because it's especially if we're talking about an addiction in a teenager at a young age in a family, then there's a family system and there's a function. Again, there's a function for the drug, but there's a function for the addict in the family.
Right.
So if you take him away, work on him and send him back to the same environment, he's going to go back into his own role.
Right. Yeah.
So, so a lot of the time you need to work with the family as well. I don't do that personally, but I know people who do that. So we work, when you work on treating addiction, a lot of the times you work on the, you work as a team. You don't work as an individual.
Yeah. I think there's that, what you mentioned about the function, which I think is super interesting, because what people don't realize is whatever relationship you have with someone, you're both contributing to
exactly.
it. And you're both putting something in there that's allowing whatever that relationship to form.
Yes.
And so that person, that addict in your family, did not form themselves and form their habits and form how they deal with you in isolation.
Exactly.
You contributed to that. And so there's work that needs to be done on yourself as well. And there's accountability that needs to be taken on how you're enabling that behavior.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is where in the Middle East you'll find a lot of resistance, because you say that to a family and their first reaction, but the problem is not me, it's that, it's this person. And a lot of the times you'll have a family walk in and they're so frustrated, fix this.
Yeah.
Fix that individual. Well, it's not only him that's the problem. He's the one demonstrating the problem, but there's a problem within the rest of the family as well. But you say that, and you're
so
not. you don't become the most liked therapist.
So I guess if you're someone who is noticing that you're starting to have unhealthy habits with any kind of substance or behavior or whatever, what advice do you have to those people before it even gets to the point of, let's say, addiction? If it's still in that space where they're maybe between getting to the point of abuse and they're starting to like notice maybe some red flags in their own behavior.
Yeah.
What are some, I guess, recommendations you have or advice you have?
I would recommend that they get themselves to any kind of professional help as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because preventing the addiction from developing is so much easier than actually working on the addiction once it happens.
Right.
So it's so whether it's psychotherapy, there's a lot of support groups, all kinds of support groups for different kinds of addictions. And then there's outpatient programs. There's a lot of different treatments.
Mm-hmm.
But then definitely getting help and looking at not only, again, not only your tendency of using the drug and the pattern of using the drug, whatever that drug is, but also what is the function? What does it do to you? Why is it important to you?
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes a level of self-awareness, I
think. Yes, it takes a lot of self-awareness. That's why a lot of the times it's easier to just go to therapy, because sometimes that kind of self-awareness is not there. It's, we're not, the way we're socialized and the way we grew up is not in a way that promotes any kind of introspection or looking inwards. We're always looking outwards, and this generation is even worse with the social media. So so that's not a natural thing that people are going to be able to do, and it's sometimes hard to be able to see your own patterns of behavior. So that's where therapy can be very helpful.
No, very true. And so let's say you've realized that you are suffering from addiction. What are some of the methods of seeking treatment in the region?
It's, there are different methods. Hospitalization is one method, and usually it's very beneficial for detox, because you need to get the drug out of your system.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times, especially when we're talking about the hardcore drugs, they're not... The withdrawal symptoms are horrible, and they need to be supervised by a doctor.
Okay.
So that's the number one thing is hospitalization, different therapeutic communities. So whether it's psychotherapy or group therapy or support groups or communities, these are all availabilities. There's all kinds of groups like AA, NA. AA, Alcoholic Anonymous, NA is Narcotics Anonymous. And then there's Al-Anon even with for the families. Mm. So the families have their own, again, anonymous groups that they could go to and discuss their struggles.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And it's all over the world, in pretty much every city in the world, you'll find a program like that. There are sober houses where you go, and it's, again, a support community for you to stay sober. Mm-hmm. And there's outpatient programs, of course, and psychotherapy.
You said the word doctor, and it just kind of reminded me of something I want to talk about, which is, what onus is there on doctors in the region who are prescribing and over-prescribing prescription drugs like Xanax and like all these kinds of different things? Because I feel like that is something that's happening more and more.
Oh, yeah.
Where people are just going and they know which doctor. Like, you know, every city has like the list of doctors that you just go to and you just walk in and you're like, hi, I'd like a few strips of Xanax, please. And they just kind of hand you the prescription. I mean,
funny enough, you don't even have to be known. You can be a psychologist and then get appointments where people are like, oh, do you prescribe drugs? No. Okay. I don't want to make an appointment.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Things like that happens a lot. Look, again, there are no numbers. Mm-hmm. And there are some countries where you'll find that substances are extremely controlled. So substances like that are extremely controlled. The UAE being one of them.
Yes.
Yeah. You can't even get a mildly strong painkiller without your doctor having to go through hoops for it.
Yeah.
And then there are countries where it's I'm not going to name, but then you can get Xanax from the pharmacy without even a prescription. You can walk in and be like, oh, can I have some Xanax? And they'll give it to you.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's in the Middle East, it really varies as to what is how controlled the substances are. I mean, I think and you can see that governments are getting more and more aware of the problem and getting more and more aware of the prescription drug problem.
Yeah.
That it is increasing and kind of increasing their hold on it and keeping the doctors
a little more accountable.
More accountable.
Yeah.
But then it is going to happen anyway. I mean, you can't expect everybody to be acting ethically.
And there's also a sense of maybe educating yourself if you're going to a psychologist or a psychiatrist for the first time, because they might just decide, hey, I'm just going to prescribe you this. And because, I mean, I've heard stories of people who go in with slight anxiety and it's like, oh, yeah, here's Xanax. And it's just like, okay, that might have not been the best situation for that person. So maybe understand a little more of what you're taking or what's being prescribed to you before you decide to kind of take
reading up on the drugs that you're prescribed is key and very, very important. And even on painkillers that you're being prescribed. So not only drugs, and being aware of your own tendencies and personality oh no, I don't, that's not going to be a very good situation for me. Medication is not the only option. It always seems like the easiest option because we live in a world that's controlled by pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
And this is what the world is telling you. Pop a pill for everything. And at this point, they have a pill for everything. So, but then it's important to go back and ask yourself, what is that going to do to my body? Look at the research. Most of the time, there's not going to be a long-term effects research.
Right.
And to me, that is alarming. And people should research what they're being prescribed all the time.
Okay. That's some good advice. What, in your opinion, is needed in the region to help battle addiction?
I think a lot more awareness, but awareness in terms of opening up and talking about it. Nobody's talking about it.
Mm.
It's a source of shame when you have a child who a family who has somebody in the family who's struggling with addiction. It's like it's a secret. It's a source of shame. We don't talk about it. We have to hide it. Something is wrong, and there isn't anything that's wrong. It's an illness like any other illness. It's like being struck by cancer. It's just not cancer. And the thing is that to add shame to that, shame grows in the dark. So when you add shame to the addiction is going to grow.
Right.
But when you put it in the light and when you allow the individual to talk about their journey, to talk about their problems, for the siblings and the family to be able to talk about how difficult it is to grow up with somebody who's struggling with addiction. And it's traumatizing for family members as well.
Right.
That's something that that sheds light and then helps the person heal. In that, and then it helps the community to understand what's going on. It's being addiction is viewed in the media or in television. I don't think it's an accurate description of what addiction is like. Very rarely do you have an accurate portrayal of what it's like to battle an addiction and to struggle with a drug. And
it's villainized, especially in Middle Eastern media, yes. I feel. And it makes it so much worse for anyone who's actually dealing with it.
Yeah.
I loved what you said about shame grows in the dark, because I think people don't realize that, that when you're struggling with something and you're keeping it to yourself, you're just going to feel more and more shame, and that's just going to grow and grow as long as you're kind of afraid that people will find out, and that's just going to kind of exasperate the problem more and more.
Yeah. Recent research is showing that one of the things that really is opposite to addiction is connection. Once you're able to connect to others, you're less likely to use a drug. You know what stops connection? It's shame.
Right.
Is there something about me that if you see it, you will not like me and you won't connect to me? So the more shame you have, the less likely you are to connect, and the less likely you are to connect, the more likely you are to go and use a drug, because you're unable to connect, so you're going to develop the connection with the drug.
Right.
So it's somewhat of a vicious circle, and it all comes from that sense of shame. In Egypt, where I come from, you don't quote unquote marry into a family that has a member who struggled with a drug addiction. That's something common within Middle Eastern cultures and Middle Eastern countries. So if you have something like that strong of a reaction to an illness, at the end of the day, it is an illness. How do you expect people to come out and be able to say, well, this is my story, this is what I struggled with, or this is what I battle? And addiction is a life battle. So once you're struggling with it, you're going to struggle with it for the rest of your life. So for it to be a battle that somebody's fighting on their own, in shame, very scared that people will find out, in hiding, families hiding, kind of not talking about those dark years that my son had at a certain point of their lives, it's just, this is not going to be a long-term solution.
Okay. I love that. That's an amazing quote to end on before we jump into the three questions we ask all our guests. So the first question is, what is the part of the culture you grew up in that you carry with you always?
Sense of humor.
Okay. I like that. Tell me more.
Well, Egyptians are funny, or at least to me, I find them very funny.
Okay.
So I think that this is something that I carry with me even at work. I mean, a lot of my connection with my clients and a lot of the therapy happens sometimes that we're laughing about stuff, or we make jokes about situations lighter. So, okay. Yeah.
And what is the quality you most value in the people you keep around you?
Authenticity. I really enjoy being around people who are true to themselves and true to what they believe. I think that's part of the reason why I enjoy my work so much, because it's, at the end of the day, nobody comes to therapy in order to not be true. They open up and they show the most raw sides of themselves, and I love that.
And last question is, what makes you happy?
But these days, my dog, being in nature, a lot of makes me very happy. Being around again, authentic people, seeing awareness being raised around mental health topics, and for to see a show like that where you're trying to talk about this, the subjects that nobody's talking about,
yeah.
And there are so many of those in the Middle East, and it's a step forward towards kind of battling shame.
Thank you. Well, that's it. That's our last question. How was your first podcast?
Yeah, that was good.
Well, thank you so much, Reem, for joining me on today's episode. Where can people find out more about you or your work or anything you're working on at the moment?
I have an Instagram account. It's Reem Shaheen ED. I'm sure you're going to...
Yeah, we'll put it in the episode description.
In the episode description. And I can give you you have my email address as well, so people can communicate.
Okay, we'll put that on there as well. Awesome. So thanks to everyone for listening. You can reach out to me as always on Instagram, on Millennial Millionaire's Instagram, on my Instagram, whichever one you want, if you have any kind of questions or comments. Everything's going to be in the episode description. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Rami, or wherever you're listening. Guys, we're coming close to the end of season 2, so make sure you subscribe if you want to know when season 3 comes out. This has been a production of Finial Media, and this is Imshad El-Anezi signing out. Bye, guys.